This is 1A. Happy Friday. I'm Joshua Johnson at NPR in New York. Making amends for an injustice is the right thing to do, but it's still important to say that you're sorry. Yesterday, the NYPD did just that. It publicly apologized for raiding the Stonewall Inn 50 years ago, the incident that sparked the LGBT rights movement. Meanwhile, many are calling for President Trump to apologize for insults he made on the D-Day anniversary about a decorated veteran, Special Counsel Robert Mueller. And Mr. Trump says Mexico will be sorry if it does not curb the flow of migrants across the border. Plenty to talk about on today's Friday News Roundup. Joining us here in New York is NBC's David Gura, the host of Up on MSNBC. David, welcome to the Roundup.
Hey, Joshua.
Also with us is Emma Green, staff writer at The Atlantic, where she covers politics, policy, and religion. Emma, welcome.
Hi, thanks.
And Sabri Benashour is a correspondent and host for Marketplace. Sabri, welcome.
Hi.
Let's begin with President Trump's threat to begin taxing Mexican goods this coming Monday in response to the crisis at the border. On Wednesday, Mexican officials went to D.C. to try and reach a deal with the administration. That included Vice President Mike Pence and Secretary of State Mike Pompeo. The president was away in Ireland as part of his Europe trip, but that did not stop him from weighing in on the border crisis. Here is part of what the president told the press.
The drugs that are coming in, the people that are coming in unchecked, they're swamping up, or they're coming up by the millions. Mexico can stop it. They have to stop it. Otherwise, we just won't be able to do business. It's a very simple thing. And I think they will stop it. I think they want to do something. I think they want to make a deal. And they sent their top people to try and do it. We'll see what happens today. We should know something.
Part of what the president said during his visit to Ireland. Emma Green, let me start with you. Do we have any sense of what has come of the meetings between Mexico and the U.S.? There are a lot of pieces of fine print to this threat that were opaque kind of through the week. Is anything clearer?
So the latest reporting that we have is that some progress has been made by both President Trump, but also the administration officials that have taken charge on this. Vice President Pence, Secretary of State Mike Pompeo, have all been trying to work with Mexican officials. And the latest reporting today suggests that there's some movement forward. But the clock is ticking. This deal was set to, these tariffs were set to go into place on Monday. And there is a lot at stake, both for Mexico, but also for the Americans and American businesses that will potentially be hit very hard by these tariffs.
Yeah, David, there's also, in terms of what's at stake, the flip side of that that isn't quite clear is how the president has gone about it. He's invoked a national emergency to make this happen, which is kind of an unusual tactic when you're dealing with something like trade policy.
Yeah, I want to contrast with what happened with Huawei, and we can talk about that a little bit later in the show, the Chinese tech company. But that was an issue that the White House was fighting on a national security grounds, on law enforcement grounds, and maintained throughout all of that it could do that on a separate track. It wasn't part of trade negotiations. And here you see trade being used as a mechanism to deal with national security. To pick up on what Emma was saying, you had these conversations on Wednesday that took place at a pretty high level. The administration was kind of cold on the end of that, that they'd made enough progress to do this. Conversations have continued. They are continuing at a lower level. But I just want to emphasize how this is another created crisis that the administration has had. Yes, they're slated to go into effect on Monday, but that's only because the president has said they'll go into effect on Monday. So here we are on a Friday. The president's making his return from Europe. This is going to be done by executive order. There's going to be something that has to happen for this to work. So there is a deadline in effect. But again, it's one that the president's kind of created of his own.
Yeah, created crisis or not, though, Sabri, it seems like this could still happen. Do we have any sense of what the Mexican government has offered to do to mitigate the problems at the border?
Yeah, they have offered to sort of, the idea is that they would beef up their security on their southern border, stop migrants there. The idea would be that migrants would have to apply for asylum in Mexico, not in the U.S. They'd also have to continue with this program where we keep all these asylum seekers trying to get into the U.S. in Mexico, so keep them in Mexico. And there's also a discussion of Guatemala stopping people at its border and sort of making them declare or seek asylum in that country instead of Mexico, instead of the U.S. Whether that's going to amount to anything, I don't know. I mean, Sarah Huckabee Sanders just last night said they're still planning to go right on ahead. So who knows if that's enough.
Now, some members of the administration have voiced concerns about these proposed tariffs. Here's what White House trade advisor Peter Navarro told CNN on Wednesday before the meeting between Mexican and American officials took place. Listen.
Right now, the Mexican government makes money off illegal immigration.
After the tariffs are put in place, the Mexican government will bear costs of that. We believe that these tariffs may not have to go into effect precisely because we have the Mexicans' attention. Vice President Pence will be meeting with them today. Secretary of State Pompeo and Ambassador Robert Lighthizer. So I think
let's set aside the facts for a moment.
Look at the chessboard here.
That's White House Trade Advisor Peter Navarro speaking to CNN's Jim Sciutto on Wednesday. And again, that was before the meeting between Mexico and the U.S. took place. Emma, there are some Republicans in Congress who've expressed concern. Both senators from Texas, John Cornyn and Ted Cruz, have said they're wary. Some have allegedly warned the White House that Republican senators are nearly unanimously opposed to these tariff plans. What does that mean in the larger sense? I mean, the president seems to have gone through this in a way that allows him to make it happen whether or not Congress is on his side.
That's right. And the thing that I've been watching as all of this has unfolded is the electoral map in terms of how it reflects on those members of Congress, those senators who are pushing back against this proposal, and also the voters who potentially are watching the clock, wondering if their businesses and their purchasing is going to change after these tariffs go into effect. Specifically, there's a bullseye with these tariffs on Michigan, which is a state, as we know, that's largely supported by the auto industry. This has a very complex set of relationships with Mexico in terms of trade, the kinds of parts that go back and forth. And you have to wonder whether Michigan, which is going to be a crucial swing state in 2020, whether those business leaders are looking at these tariffs and thinking, I wonder whether this administration is actually on my side.
David, with regards to these tariffs, I wonder at what point do they actually become a thing? I mean, if it's just next week, 5% is not that much money. So if it just is this little pinprick that makes the Mexican government go, okay, all right, fine, we'll do something, then how big a deal is it really in the bigger scheme of things?
And I think that's what the president's counting on, that pinprick leading them to the table as they've come to the table to talk about this more. But I've seen a lot of reporting that maybe as we get closer to the holidays, when people are buying more goods, that's when this is going to become felt more acutely. And if we get up to that 25% threshold, that's certainly going to be something. But I want to go back to what you heard there from Peter Navarro. He used the pronoun we, and I don't want to parse words too much here, but that's been the difficulty in these talks all along, is who's speaking for whom. And the president, as you said, has been away. He's been in Europe during the course of these negotiations. And yes, we've seen him weigh in on this on Twitter. He's talked about it as well in interviews that he's done from Europe. But there is an overarching uncertainty about what he's in favor of, what the metrics are for success for these conversations. And I think that makes what's already a very complicated job even more complicated, that you've got schisms, fractures within the administration, people who want one thing versus another, and then nobody's really willing to say this is going to be enough without the president coming in to do it. And that's just the way, frankly, this administration operates.
Sabri, we're going to sound like a broken record here, but it's worth repeating whenever we talk about tariffs. Emily wrote on our Facebook page, Mexico won't pay for these tariffs. U.S. consumers will. True, right?
Yes, true. I mean, when a U.S. company wants to bring in some auto part or whatever, they're the ones who are going to have to pay that extra 5%. Whether they pass it on to us or not, that is a question, and there's no doubt that some of it will get passed on. But, you know, as far as the idea of, you know, this 5%, oh, maybe it's just a little bit, no big deal. Well, it can be a very big deal. So, for example, if you have an auto part that's going to cross the border five times, crosses once, 5%, crosses twice, 5%, crosses three times, 5%, where does that get you? So I think, you know, the cost of an automobile might rise by $1,300. And that's just with an analysis of the 5%. I saw a report that the 5% level would cost us about 400,000 jobs. So it's a little mind-boggling that we are using this as a leverage point, something that could burn us so badly economically. And I think it reflects an attitude in the Trump administration that is not in alignment with how most economists would view tariffs and their danger.
With regards to that leverage point, Lynn in Tulsa asked, why are we even discussing this? We have treaties, NAFTA is still in effect, that prohibit tariffs. Emma?
Well, as we know, the Trump administration has been working double time to try to get a new paradigm in place to replace NAFTA, the U.S.-Mexico-Canada agreement. And with this, we see a kind of worldview emerging from the Trump administration that the old ways of trade are dead, that even our neighbors to the north and south are not going to be our guaranteed allies. And with something like immigration and asylum seekers, which has been this huge lightning bolt of a divisive issue in the Trump era, I think the Trump administration wants to do anything that it can to show its base that it is trying to take on this challenge of people who are trying to enter the United States from the southern border.
We're going to move on after the break. But David, is there anything that Congress can do to block these, or is just kind of the way the president's gone about it an effective end run?
Yeah, the Senate Majority Leader has reportedly said he wants to meet with the president before these go into effect to voice some of the concern that you're talking about. I think, you know, what strikes me as really fundamental here is the administration, the president in particular, doesn't understand how long trade negotiations take. I remember talking to the old U.S. trade representative back during the Obama years who was trying to hatch TPP, make that work, and the amount of travel that he had to do, the time perspective that he had to work with was so long. And you have a president here who wants things to happen immediately. To go back to what Sabri was saying about how this is going to mean for companies, they can't move as quickly, they can't react as quickly as the president thinks they can.
More in a moment with NBC's David Gura, The Atlantic's Emma Green, and Marketplace's Sabri Benishour. Coming up, we'll talk about the history of the LGBT rights movement and a moment that added to that history just this week. I'm Joshua Johnson, glad to be with you. You're listening to 1A from WAMU and NPR.
Support for NPR and the following message come from VSP Individual Vision Plans, offering coverage for a low monthly cost if you don't have vision coverage through an employer. You'll get access to the nation's largest network of independent doctors and hundreds of name brand frames. Plus, you can save more than $200 a year. VSP believes you deserve to see better for life for less. Discover for yourself at needvspcoverage.com.
Mitch McConnell has become a champion for conservatives. But back in the day, he once got support from groups like labor unions.
I mark it down as one of the worst things I've ever done in my life.
So you thought about it over the years?
Oh, I still think about it every time I see his face.
Mitch McConnell, a new series from Embedded. Subscribe now.
This is 1A. I'm Joshua Johnson in New York. It's the Friday News Roundup with Marketplace correspondent and host Sabri Benishour, Emma Green, a staff writer at The Atlantic, and NBC's David Gura, who is the host of Up on MSNBC. Let's shift gears now to the White House. President Trump was visiting the UK and the royal family. He was also there for the 75th anniversary commemoration of the D-Day attack, but according to @RealDonaldTrump on Twitter, his mind was very much back at home. We'll get into some of his tweets later, because there is another bigger story involving the administration and two of its former staffers. The White House directed Hope Hicks and Annie Donaldson to not comply with congressional subpoenas for documents from their time in the administration. Again, that's to not comply with the subpoena. David, the House Judiciary Chairman Jerry Nadler has said that Hicks has produced documents for the committee despite the White House requests, but this is kind of, it seems, part of a continuing standoff between the executive and the legislative, particularly now that the Democrats are in charge of the House.
Yeah, the stonewalling continues. The wall gets higher and higher between the White House and Congress, and you can sense the frustration that Jerry Nadler, the chair of that committee, and the other chairman have as all of this continues. And you couple that with the conversation that continues about impeachment or impeachment proceedings as a tool to do more investigative work, and things are tense, I think it's fair to say, in Washington, D.C. But you saw some movement this week. There was a lot of conversation about having a resolution next week that would hold Bill Barr in contempt of Congress, hold Don McGahn, the president's former White House counsel, in contempt as well. And you see an evolution on that. Congress wants to make sure that they have codified their ability to use the courts to enforce those subpoenas, to have the ability or the power to sue for the production of the Mueller report unredacted with the underlying evidence. And to me, this is the most fascinating turn that we've seen so far. There was a moment a few weeks back where Richard Neal, the head of the House Ways and Means Committee, who's been going back and forth with the Treasury Department trying to get the president's tax returns, decided that he wasn't going to go to the contempt route. He was just going to go straight to court. And I think the story of these last few weeks, indeed the story going forward, is going to be how the court system is used by Congress to do that. Again, as this conversation about impeachment continues, I don't see that ending anytime soon. The courts are going to take on a bigger and bigger role.
Which could also be challenging. I think the courts would like to know, at least, that Congress has done everything yes. in its power before it goes to court. But even with that, Emma, we did note that Hope Hicks did produce some documents. So how consequential is it ultimately that the White House said, don't do this, if at least one of the people is doing it? Kind of.
So I don't think we can read the tea leaves exactly for how this will play out. My money, if I were having to put money down, would be on a continued strategy of what the White House and its two of its very loyal former staffers cooperating with its directives and wanting to participate in what the White House sees as a winning strategy. As we saw from the conclusion of the Mueller report forward, every Trump administration official up to the president have seen this as a total victory, or at least are selling it as such. And I don't see them backing down from that strategy anytime soon. As we're moving into electoral high gear in the coming months, what's really going to matter about this beyond those legal machinations is the messaging around it. And I think that's just as important for the White House in terms of crafting its strategy as its sense of what legal bet might win.
There was also a story, Sabree, this week regarding one of the president's cabinet members. A number of them have been investigated for ethics violations up to now. And now, Transportation Secretary Elaine Chao is getting some heat for her family's business dealings in China. What's going on with that, and how consequential is that really?
Well, so her family owns a shipping company. It's an American shipping company. It does do business in China, does quite a bit of business in China. And on a trip, she asked federal officials to help, to help coordinate some travel arrangements for her family members and bring in some of those family members into meetings. When people started asking about that, and actually alarm bells rang in the State Department, I mean, officials called back to say, you know, according to the New York Times, officials called back and said, you know, what do we do about this? This seems really ethically problematic. We don't know what to do here. That whole trip, those meetings, that was all canceled. And no explanation given. It's hard to know exactly what these meetings were, and it is, I mean, it's hard to think of a reason why you would need to bring your family members into any kind of government meeting. At the same time, you know.
Unless they have an official role like the president's family members. So
right,
there's a bit of a precedent there.
True.
Right.
Yeah, it's hard to see. I don't know. They've painted it, they've implied that this is a little bit. That it leaves a bad taste to be going after this Chinese-American family for tenuous links to China, frankly. I mean, strong links, but links that any business would have. So I don't know.
David, the administration also moved to restrict medical research using human fetal tissue, and it's being called a win by opponents of abortion rights, a win for moving toward no research with human fetal tissue. How significant is this? Like, is this going to have widespread effects on the medical research community? Is this more like an edge case that appeals to anti-abortion voters? Like, what is this?
I think it is going to have wide-ranging ramifications. So this is reducing or restricting funding for NIH studies paid for at universities, places of research around the country, using tissue from aborted fetuses. And, you know, I think that what that tissue is used for is so wide-ranging. It could be used for HIV, other infectious disease studies. And you have a reaction that I've seen reported on in the scientific community. They don't really know what happens next as a result of this. Part of this change is there'll be these advisory boards that are supposed to be comprised, I think, of two-thirds scientists, but also attorneys and theologians. And it's just another policy that's put into place here, I think, without a lot of the groundwork laid before it happens. And you know, is it a fringe thing? Maybe in part, in that it's been pushed for on the fringes, but it's something that has been protected over these last few years. And I think, again, the ramifications for the scientific community are bound to be quite sizable.
Before we move on, it is worth coming back just briefly to the tweets, and then we're going to move on to the disaster relief bill. But briefly, the tweets. During his trip through the EU, the president tweeted a number of broadsides, one against Bette Midler, calling her a, quote, washed-up psycho, unquote. He also went after Joe Biden, went after Chuck Schumer. To be fair, he did tweet from the D-Day commemoration, so he didn't completely ignore the purpose of his trip. He tweeted out pictures of the event and wrote, quote, "To the men who sit behind me and to the boys who rest in the field before me, your example will never grow old, your legend will never tire, and your spirit, brave, unyielding, and true, will never die," unquote. Contrast that with another tweet where he wrote, quote, "Can you imagine crying Chuck Schumer saying out loud for all to hear that I am bluffing with respect to putting tariffs on Mexico? What a creep. He would rather have our country fail with drugs and immigration than give Republicans a win. But he gave Mexico bad advice. No bluff." Unquote. So
everybody rendered speechless.
Net positive, net negative? I don't know. And honestly, like, I don't know. I'm starting to get very comfortable ignoring everything the president tweets, except when he tweets policy. But I don't know. Am I just too bored with @RealDonaldTrump?
Look, my colleague Rachel Donadio, who covers Europe for The Atlantic, actually went to Normandy to visit the beaches where American soldiers came on D-Day. And her piece, to me, sort of encapsulated the real tension here, that cognitive dissonance between the tone that the president strikes on Twitter and the way that a lot of Americans think about this extraordinary moment in our history and this devastating moment in our history. And I think this is one of the big takeaways that historically, when we're looking back 20 or 30 years from now, I think we're going to look back and think, was this a marking moment where the president of the United States really took us in a different direction in terms of decorum and performance and this type of reverence for these events that have typically really brought seriousness to the hearts of Americans, to American presidents? And so, you know, that's not a new thing. We've been seeing that now for, you know, nigh on 4 years, and we may continue to see it moving forward, doubtless. But I just think it's worth, with something like D-Day, hovering on that and not just making it a natural part of our American life, that this is something that's not usual.
David?
Yeah, I just want to go back to what I was saying about trade and those negotiators looking for clues from the president about what he wants. And I think that you have to look at these tweets, at least in some capacity, as that. It's the president transmitting what he thinks about something, as banal it is, as it is, or as consequential it is. But that act of trying to read those tea leaves is complicated by changes in time zones. But I go back to the trip to Japan, when he tweeted out what he did about Joe Biden and the crime bill. It is him putting down some sort of marker that I don't think you can ignore completely. And when you look at what happened while he was in Europe, while he was in London, and then I guess in Normandy for the day, and Shannon, Ireland at night, as he went back and forth between these two places, perplexingly, when he weighed in on tariffs, when he weighed in on some matters of substance, it's something that I think his staff takes note of, and you see it percolating in what they say when they're responding to the press.
Sibri, one of the things the president is expected to do in the days to come is to sign a long-awaited disaster relief bill. There are towns and farmers up and down the Arkansas, Missouri, and Mississippi rivers who are still dealing with major flooding. Months of unusually heavy rain have caused rivers to surge. They've broken levees. They've flooded fields and streets. And the higher concern about this may have pushed Congress to pass this bill this week. It's worth $19 billion. Sibri, give us a sense of what changed in this bill. If nothing else, the funding for aid to Puerto Rico was a big part of the debate over what this bill would ultimately look like.
Yeah, that was the sticking point. The president thought that Puerto Rico was getting too much money, despite all the disasters that it had gone through. So I think what eventually happened was just the pile of need just grew so big that people just relented. And they were like, okay, this is starting to be a little bit embarrassing. Let's just pass this thing.
Do we have a better sense, Emma, of who this bill will help and where it will help them more broadly?
Well, I think the key here is that it helps voters who are in Trump country, all of the states that have been hit very hard by natural disasters. And I mean a string of extraordinary disasters that has stretched throughout the spring, of floods and storms and all of this damage that has really hit the Midwest pretty hard. Those are voters who are core in Trump's base. And so I think in that way, it sets up the politics here a little bit differently, that there's some upside to the Trump administration signaling that it's paying attention to this really economically devastating and personally devastating set of storms.
Do we have a sense, Emma, of whether this money will be enough or whether there's more aid to come?
You know, I'm not sure about that. And honestly don't know that there is high levels of attention to this. As we heard from Sabrina just a moment ago, it took a little bit of wrangling, actually, to me, a surprising amount of wrangling to get this through. So I do wonder in the coming weeks whether we're going to see more attention to this, whether we're going to see effective advocacy on the part of the legislators and senators who come from those states to try to get that kind of aid money to going to their constituents.
Last Friday, a former city government employee in Virginia Beach opened fire at the municipal building there. He killed 12 of his co-workers. Virginia's Governor Ralph Northam has called for a special session to take up a package of gun control legislation. Listen.
No one should go to work, to school, or to church wondering if they will come home. And so I will summon the members of the Senate and the House of Delegates to meet in special session for the purpose of passing common sense public safety law.
That was Virginia's Governor Ralph Northam speaking at a press conference in Richmond on Tuesday. David Gura, what is your sense of whether Governor Northam can get anything done? I mean, if it couldn't get done in Connecticut after Sandy Hook, in Colorado after Columbine, I mean, in Virginia after Virginia Tech, what is it exactly that Governor Northam thinks he's going to get done this time?
So I was in Virginia Beach on Saturday. I've regrettably covered too many of these, a number of them, and there is a rhythm to the day following one of these things that is so sad to see. The makeshift memorials that begin with people bringing flowers and cards and praying, and there behind that memorial was the parking lot in front of that building, and as the day went on, the FBI was allowing those who had parked cars there to remove them. And that happens in each of these locations. I was struck during the course of that day, talking to lawmakers at the local, state, federal level, by how similar the sentence is at the end, which is something has to change, something has to be different. I had a conversation with Senator Richard Blumenthal of Connecticut. Of course, Connecticut has gone through too many of these as well. And we talked about the role of the states going forward here. And you can look at Maryland, you can look at New York, you can look at California. These are states that have implemented legislation, gun policies that are more restrictive than they are in many states and certainly at the federal level. And I said to him, is that where we should be looking at this point? To your question, if there is so much inaction at the federal level, should more faith be placed in the states? And he pushed back on me a little bit to say, if you look at 2018, there were plenty of candidates for the House who ran on gun policy changes. It's becoming a viable electoral issue. I talked to Senator Cory Booker, who thinks that this can be a policy and political issue in the 2020 campaign for president. But I think that what you hear from Governor Northam there is some optimism that when this happens in your backyard, you're going to let common sense prevail. You're going to push for changes that might be harder to do in a Senate that is known for its inaction more than anything else at this point. I don't know whether his optimism will be met with reality.
Sabri, what about that? This idea that there may be tipping point is the wrong expression, but that it reaches a point where it becomes a presidential political issue that voters are willing to say, okay, if you are willing to do something, you may be president. If you aren't, you may not.
I honestly don't really know that we are there yet. I mean, as you exactly pointed out, we've gone through so many crises, and there is this ritual that David pointed out of, you know, contrition and hand-wringing and, you know, let's do something, and then nothing really happens. And so I don't see what catalyst has changed. If it's not a dozen, you know, dead children, and if it wasn't a you know, dead kids at a nightclub, and if it's not dead municipal workers, I don't know what would bring, you know, these sides together, whether it's an election year or not.
Or for that matter, students who are killed in a high school like Marjorie Stoneman Douglas in Parkland, Florida. That was another story that moved this week. A former school resource officer, basically a Broward Sheriff's Office deputy assigned to the school at Douglas High School, is facing 11 charges now, including child negligence. Prosecutors are charging Scott Peterson for his alleged inaction during the Parkland shooting that killed 17 people last February. Peterson was released from jail yesterday on a lower bond. Much more to discuss with NBC's David Gura, Emma Green of The Atlantic, and Marketplace's Sabri Benishour. We'll focus on New York in just a moment, crime statistics, Mayor Bill de Blasio running for president, and of course the apology regarding Stonewall. But first, we say farewell to two artists from New Orleans. Leah Chase was known as the Queen of NOLA Cuisine. She started showcasing her Southern culinary skills as early as the 50s in a restaurant she co-owned with her husband. It became a meeting place for organizers of the civil rights movement. Chase wrote 3 cookbooks and gained an audience outside of New Orleans as a TV personality and arts philanthropist. Leah Chase died this week. She lived to be 96. Also, Malcolm John Rebinac helped Creole music be more than just a local specialty. We knew him better as Dr. John. The singer-songwriter helped catapult New Orleans funk, jazz, and blues into the mainstream in the 70s. He became a Rock and Roll Hall of Fame inductee in 2011. Dr. John died this week at age 77. Disney fans may know that these two have a connection. Tiana, the protagonist of The Princess and the Frog, was said to be modeled on Leah Chase. And the movie's soundtrack includes Down in New Orleans by Dr. John, which he dedicated to Leah Chase. We'll get back to the roundup in just a minute. Stay close.
Support for 1A and the following message come from the Platinum Card from American Express. Conversations and civil debate in our society push us forward and connect us with the rest of the world. With the Platinum Card, earn 5x membership rewards points on flights booked directly with airlines or with American Express Travel. That's the powerful backing of American Express. Don't live life without it. Visit americanexpress.com/exploreplatinum. Terms apply.
Human behavior doesn't always make a ton of sense, at least on the surface.
I said, would you mind if I give the dogs a little piece of cracker with some hot sauce on it and without, and see what they choose?
Hidden Brain, a spicy podcast about science, psychology, and why people do what they do.
Back now to the roundup with Emma Green of The Atlantic, Sabri Benishour of Marketplace, and NBC's David Gura. We should take a moment to mention the new jobs numbers that came out this week. We got a comment from a listener, Aaron, who wrote on our Facebook page, many fewer jobs created than expected in May, 75,000 rather than the projected 175,000, plus LFPR, the labor force participation rate, which conservatives have told me for years is actually the most important unemployment number, remains unchanged. I hope this isn't a signal of bad things to come and is instead just a blip. Sabri, what about Aaron's comment?
Well, if it's a blip, it's the second blip we've had in just a few months. And there were some major downward revisions. So, yes, we got 75,000 jobs. We lost 75,000 jobs in the revision. So the net gain is zero at this point over the last several months. There's sort of some good news and some bad news. The good news is you only need 100,000 jobs per month on average to keep the unemployment rate steady, and the 3-month average is still at 150,000. Wage growth is okay. It's down to 3.1% from 3.2. But this survey was done before, for example, all this Mexico tariffs stuff came up. We also saw some sectors that had a real tough time for a long time, like retail. They've lost jobs 8 out of the past 9 reports. So it's a mix. It's not nothing, but we just have to wait and see what happens.
One more story from the administration regarding immigration we should get to before we focus on New York. The administration's family separation policy is still in full force at the southern border. This week, ICE admitted to a series of botched reunifications, including an incident where dozens of children, some as young as 5 years old, were left inside locked vans overnight. I mentioned we discussed immigration policy this week, but David, what is the story here? Is this also, to borrow the term again, just a blip, one of those things that we hear about and, oh my goodness, I can't believe it happened, or is this typical of a pattern?
I'm going to tip my hat to my colleagues Jacob Soboroff and Julia Ainsley, who reported that piece for us at NBC, and they've been doing a lot on this separation policy. I mean, it's a haunting story. You had vans of children headed to a reunification point. They were supposed to meet with family there, and as you mentioned, waited for hours and hours and hours. I think someone waited as long as 2 days for that to happen. So 2 nights, in vans waiting for this to happen. And what Jacob and Julia point out in that piece is it's emblematic of the administration not being able to do what it says it's going to do. And the quotations that you read from emails they obtained from folks who were at that facility say they weren't prepared for this. They weren't alerted to this was supposed to happen. They didn't have the infrastructure in place to do these reunifications. Suffice to say that that's no excuse for leaving kids in a locked van for 2 nights. So I would agree with what they're saying. That is, the policy was plagued with problems. They promised things that were unable they were unable to follow through on, and now we're seeing those problems continue as they try to account for all that they had in their custody.
One more comment from our audience before we move on to New York. John wrote on our Facebook page, "The conversation regarding immigration has become far too clinical. We can yammer about trade negotiations all we want, but the upshot is the Republican Party marking people of another culture and skin color as inferior and keeping children in concentration camps on our southern border. This isn't a discussion of the results of an MRI. This is a human calamity." Emma, I hear where John is coming from. This also feels like the kind of political rhetoric that I'm not knocking John's comment. But if you heard a candidate on the campaign trail say that Republicans are putting children in concentration camps, holy crap.
I mean, certainly that would be a throwdown.
Yeah.
But the things that we're hearing from Democrats, those who are currently in the field for 2020, is not so different. And I think, honestly, the perception among Democratic voters may not be so different. The worlds I watch, which are often populated by religious leaders, religious voters, church communities, people who are really involved in this issue at the border and the humanitarian cost of it, there is just a drumbeat of attention to it, this call to not turn away, to not look away from the humanitarian impact that the administration is exerting on these children. And the thing I've also heard over and over from people from a wide range across the political spectrum is the sense that this is something we cannot stand for as Americans, this treatment of children just because they come from another country or have a different color of skin, that they're treated very, very differently than American children would be treated.
Let's focus on New York for the remainder of our time. Back in 2014, you may recall that an NYPD officer named Daniel Pantaleo put a man named Eric Garner in a chokehold that was caught on video. It caught Garner's pleas on tape, making the phrase, "I can't breathe," a rallying cry for the Black Lives Matter movement. Now, Sabri, yesterday, attorneys delivered their final arguments in the disciplinary trial for Officer Pantaleo. Talk to us about what this represents in a larger sense. This is about more than one man's death, especially, I think, in the minds of a lot of people in New York, on Staten Island, where this happened. There's more involved behind this.
Yeah, well, first of all, it's worth pointing out that this trial is not a criminal trial. It's just for his job. It is just for his job. And
so if he loses, he's fired, not jailed.
He's fired, not jailed. Now, despite that, because there hasn't been any other form of closure, really, for people in this, they are piling a lot of significance onto it. And I think for that reason, people are going to be following the arguments very closely. And it was just, the arguments were very notable. So Eric Garner's attorney said that his, the police officer's attorney said that Eric Garner basically died from his cardiovascular condition, and that the officer used didn't use a band chokehold, but a seat belt move, which had never been taught to him before. I think everything about this is going to be inflammatory to anyone who cares about it on either side.
David, another story about bad behavior by law enforcement, but this one's kind of playing out in the court of public opinion with regards to the prosecutor who oversaw the conviction of the so-called Central Park Five. Her name's Linda Fairstein, and she is getting more scrutiny 30 years after this happened. It is largely due to the popularity of a new Netflix miniseries called When They See Us.
Yes, it's Ava DuVernay's new project for Netflix, and Linda Fairstein, who went on from being the head of the sex crimes unit to writing a lot of successful novels, being a talking head on legal issues on TV, had this long career, as you say, about 30 years in length after all of that took place. This docudrama, I guess you could call it that, reimagining of what happened back in 1989, is casting her in a new light or bringing what she did to the attention of more people. There has been this big social media campaign, Cancel Linda Fairstein. She's stepped down from the board of Vassar, where she went to school, from a lot of nonprofits as well. She's characterizing this as a misrepresentation of who she is, who she was, what she did, and saying as much in her letters of resignation to these boards. But it does show the power of this kind of filmmaking. I think for sure you'll remember that Ken Burns and his daughter did a documentary on the Central Park Five a couple of years ago, and that certainly brought this case to light again. But as you have the president tweeting, as I said, about the crime bill of 1994, a lot of people revisiting the role that he played back in 1989, the ads that he took out in newspapers calling for the death penalty, passing judgment on the five then boys, then children who were involved, wrapped up in all of this. The film is doing what it's doing, bringing this to light. It's also part of this larger cultural conversation about what happened, I think, in the late 80s and early 90s when it came to crime.
And here's a quick clip of Felicity Huffman playing Linda Fairstein in When They See Us.
And way up here, they brutally raped a woman and discarded her like a piece of garbage. Left her for dead. Bleeding. Bound. And to think we were going to release these animals to family court and put them back on the streets.
That's Felicity Huffman as Linda Fairstein in When They See Us. We should note, by the way, that an attorney for Ms. Fairstein has said that they tried to work with Netflix and Ava DuVernay to get their side of the story told in what they consider a more accurate way. Ava DuVernay pulls back and says that one of, among the things that Fairstein wanted was some script approval. So there's still a little back and forth in terms of what went on there. Emma, we should also note the NYPD reported a spike in hate crimes this week in the 60s, in the city. 64%. Over last year, fueled mostly by a surge in anti-Semitic crimes. Now, the city has vowed to reverse this trend. They say they're opening a new office for the prevention of hate crimes as part of the mayor's office this summer. What's going on with this spike, and what do we expect this office to do?
So it's important to note that hate crimes against Jews in New York City is not a new thing. And this is particularly true in neighborhoods of Brooklyn and Lower Manhattan, where there are large populations of visibly Orthodox Jews, people who can be singled out on the streets for attacks, violence, harassment. I've been reporting on another phenomenon in New York City that actually has come to intersect with this, which is the rise of measles. So there has been an outbreak of measles in New York City and in the county surrounding New York City. This is the largest outbreak since measles was eradicated from the United States, and it's largely been concentrated in the Orthodox population. And what I've seen in my reporting is time and time again, people saying that they are being called out for being diseased Jews, people who have nothing to do with the measles, being shouted at on the streets. There was a rabbi in Rockland County, north of New York City, who said that he, at a drugstore with his wife and family, got yelled at by some teens who said, Hitler should have killed more of you with the measles, right? So there's just this intersection with anti-Semitism of all of these other factors that somebody might not actually naturally connect, but that end up getting entered into this hateful bloodstream of violence and harassment against Jews, which is a very standard pattern in how hate crimes get committed.
And what exactly is it the city plans to do to deal with this?
So we've seen from the de Blasio administration a promise to open a new hate crimes office on an expedited schedule, but there are also questions about how they're partnering with the community and whether they actually have the trust of those people who are being attacked.
There was an apology this week that some might say was 50 years in the making. The commissioner of the NYPD, James P. O'Neill, spoke yesterday about the anniversary of the Stonewall riots. Here's what he said.
The actions taken by the NYPD were wrong, plain and simple. The actions and the laws were discriminatory and oppressive, and for that, I apologize. I vow to the LGBTQ community that this would never happen in NYPD 2019. We have and we do embrace all New Yorkers, and we are a department that is inclusive.
That's New York Police Commissioner James P. O'Neill speaking yesterday, and that apology came as what for some was a very welcome surprise because this is LGBT Pride Month. Pride celebrations kick off across the country this month. A.C. Monroe, one of our frequent flyers on Twitter, wrote, "As a poor, openly gay man, I find it appalling that the NYPD is now trying to do a PR campaign by issuing an, quote-unquote, apology for discrimination, violence, and oppression of the LGBT community for generations. Their words are hollow as they continue to kill and oppress minorities." Sabri, what about this? I see where AC's coming from. On the other hand, for the NYPD, which used to raid gay bars with impunity and just could give a damn about the people inside, this is a big historic leap that would have seemed unthinkable 50 years ago.
Yeah. I mean, yes, it is certainly better that they apologize than they not. Now, I think that this does bring to the fore how current modern LGBT issues have become a lot more inclusive of other issues as well. And when you start to mix issues together, then it's harder to have a clean break, you know, with the past, or it's harder to have a simple it's hard to have a simple response to instances like this, because everything becomes more nuanced and interconnected and harder to parse. But at the end of the day, it's better that they apologize for it than not.
Yeah, and New York will be having a gigantic Pride celebration this year, the 50th anniversary of Stonewall. Yeah. I know plenty of people who are flying in from all over the country and the world to be here at the end of this month.
Yeah, it's World Pride, too.
World Pride, that's right. That is also this month. One more story out of New York that caught our attention. They say that time is money, and New Yorkers hate to waste time. But how much money would you pay to save time in traffic? Next month, Uber will offer a new way to get to JFK Airport, an on-demand helicopter. Getting to Kennedy from Manhattan can easily take an hour or two or more, depending on driving conditions or transit delays. Uber Copter will fly you from a heliport near the Staten Island Ferry to a helipad near JFK's Terminal 8. Total flight time, about 8 minutes. But saving all that time will cost some real money, at least $200 per person. Now, Uber's not the first company to offer this. Another one called Blade flies to Kennedy, LaGuardia, and Newark for about $200. Some New Yorkers say too many choppers fly over the city as it is, making a noisy city way noisier. A local campaign called Stop the Chop is pushing to ban helicopter sightseeing trips. David, I can see the gear. I can smell the smoke coming out of your ears.
I am one of those guys in his minivan grousing at the traffic on the way to Kennedy. I was struck, Josh, as I read about this, that there's a real strict limit on what kind of luggage you can bring. So as a guy who has some kids, not feasible for me.
There is a service with Blade, I think, where they'll pick up your luggage and meet you at JFK.
A courier service. Very good.
NBC's David Gora, the host of Up on MSNBC, and as fate will have it, I will be on his panel tomorrow morning.
Sir.
So, David, thank you, and I'll see you tomorrow.
I look forward to seeing you.
Emma Green, a staff writer at The Atlantic. Emma, thanks for joining us.
Thank you so much.
And Sabri Benashour, a correspondent and host for Marketplace. Thanks, Sabri.
Thank you.
Before we leave you, the Tony Awards are this Sunday night. The nominees for Best Musical include two adaptations of Tootsie and Beetlejuice. Also nominated are The Prom, Hadestown, and Ain't Too Proud, The Life and Times of the Temptations. 1A's lead sound engineer is Jake Cherry, with technical help from Josephine Neonai. Our digital team is Gabrielle Healy and Catherine Fink. We'll jump into international headlines next. Stay close.
Support for NPR comes from Newman's Own Foundation, working to nourish the common good by donating all profits from Newman's Own food products to charitable organizations that seek to make the world a better place. More information is available at newmansownfoundation.org. Support for this podcast and the following message come from Kay Buxbaum in support of the David Gilkey and Zabiula Tamana Memorial Fund, established to strengthen NPR's commitment to training and protecting journalists in high-risk environments.
This is 1A. I'm Joshua Johnson at NPR in New York. American and European leaders came together to honor those who gave their lives at Normandy 75 years ago, helping end World War II. In China, it can still get you into trouble if you talk openly about the Tiananmen Square massacre. That happened 30 years ago this week. This is the last official week that UK's Prime Minister Theresa May heads the Conservative Party, having been defeated by Brexit. Also, Ethiopia's Prime Minister mediates talks in Sudan aimed at restoring peace. And we have two stories on temptation, one for the devout and one to devour. Joining us here in New York for the Friday News Roundup is Daniel Kurtz-Phelan, the executive editor of Foreign Affairs. He's also the author of The China Mission, George Marshall's Unfinished War, 1945-47, which is just out in paperback. Dan, welcome to 1A.
Thank you for having me.
Also with us is Kate Brannon, the editorial director of Just Security, an online forum on national security. Kate, welcome.
Thanks so much for having me.
And back with us is Hayes Brown, the deputy world news editor for BuzzFeed News. Hayes, glad to have you back.
Glad to be here.
Since we're beginning with D-Day, we've heard from a few folks who said that the D-Day anniversary has sparked some new conversations in their family, including learning some of their family's connections to World War II that they did not know about. If that's part of what happened with you this week as a result of the news or Tiananmen Square, we'd love to hear your story, 1A@WAMU.org. Well, as we said, this week marked the 75th anniversary of Allied forces storming the beaches of France during World War II. D-Day was the beginning of the end of Nazi-occupied Europe, and it came at a very high cost. More than 4,400 Allied troops that we know of died on D-Day. More than 9,000 were wounded or missing. We don't know how many German troops were killed, but the death estimates are between 4 and 9,000. Here is one of the first reports on D-Day from James Willard of CBS News.
I have just seen the first American troops preparing to storm ashore onto the continent of Europe. They were about to land on the north coast of France at 6:30 British summer time this morning. At 6:23, the Marauder bomber in which I was riding dropped the last load of bombs to be launched onto the coastal targets before H hour a few minutes later, when our landing barges would strike the shore. All night and from dawn onwards, thousands of Allied planes have been softening up a strip of coast. Already, several thousand paratroopers are waiting further inland to join forces with the landing parties. These airborne troops were flown in last night. I could see evidence of the landings in a number of parachutes lying in the little fields. But I must say at once, the amazing feature of my flight this morning was the almost unbelievable quietness of the scene below, where, in the next few days, maybe in the next few hours, decisive battles for the reconquest of Europe will be fought.
Indeed they were, as first reported by James Willard of CBS News. President Trump and other world leaders attended memorial ceremonies to honor the veterans of the invasion and other World War II battles. Kate Brennan, let me start with you. Tell us a bit about some of the commemoration ceremonies in Normandy.
Well, you had the Chancellor of Germany, Angela Merkel. You had the President of France, Macron, there. And, you know, their unified position is sort of the essence of the post-World War II, to see them there together. And then, of course, you had Donald Trump came, and they all gave speeches at the site. Of course, Donald Trump, you know, one thing that sort of got a lot of attention is he sat down for an interview with Fox News right before going on, going to the ceremony. So sort of his attendance there was a bit of a distraction from what is really a solemn affair. It's likely this is the last anniversary, big anniversary, that the men who, the vets, the survivors of D-Day, will be able to attend, given their age. You know, the next one will be the 80th anniversary, and they're really, you know, they're in their 90s now.
Hayes Brown, it's interesting to look at the world order today compared to the way things were in and after World War II, especially concerning some of the alliances that were forged between the U.S. and the rest of the world during and after that war to prevent what would literally be a World War III.
Right. I completely agree with that. And it's interesting to see how the world leaders there spoke about what happened after World War II during their speeches, which is to say that President Trump didn't really reference the post-war order that the United States helped set up, you know, Bretton Woods, United Nations, this idea that the world can come together and through these alliances prevent another war, and through these institutions that Trump has never really seemed to care for. Instead, it was President Macron who had to be like, no, this is a big deal, this thing that we've managed to accomplish over these last 75 years, building towards peace and stability. So I think that it's really fascinating to see that Russia, who was, you know, not at D-Day, they were fighting on the Eastern Front, the Russian Ministry of Foreign Affairs chose to put on Twitter a tweet reminding everyone, by the way, guys, D-Day was not the beginning of the end. That was Stalingrad, and the Allies were dragging their feet before they came into D-Day. So I think that that challenge to the narrative at that time, when Russia is working so hard to destabilize this post-World War
post-World War II order, it's just really fascinating to look at.
Which is not, let's just be clear, the Russians aren't entirely correct. I mean, Stalingrad was peace. The Nazis were squeezed on both sides. Normandy from the west, Stalingrad from the east.
This has been Moscow's line since Stalin, that we were doing all the hard work, you guys.
Exactly.
So, but for them to trot that out on this anniversary, which is really telling to me.
Well, and then Daniel Kurtzfehlen, one of the other institutions post-war that has been so important, is NATO. And, you know, the one time that NATO's had to invoke its Article 5, the like an attack on one is an attack on all, was the September 11th terror attacks. You've written a lot about the institutions that were put in place to try to ensure lasting peace.
That's right. The entire ceremony, as I saw it, felt a bit like a family that doesn't really get along gathering and trying really hard to be nice. So everyone said sort of the right thing. People really were on pretty good behavior, and I think that included President Trump. He talked about cherished alliances. Hayes is right that he did not at length talk about the institutions that grew out of this moment, but he did say the right things. He talked about veterans. He talked about the sacrifices of others. But what he did not do, and it really fell to others to do, was to talk about the lessons of this moment, and that really comes down to the institutions, the alliances, the European Union that have helped prevent a return to great power war in Europe over the past 75 years. And that's something that Donald Trump just expresses skepticism about at every turn.
He does indeed. But Kate, the lessons of World War II, at least from my perspective and from what Hayes just mentioned, are not lost on the rest of the world. You know, the president has been, since the beginning of his administration, very much an outlier in terms, especially of the NATO nations, the nations of the United Nations. Like, the rest of the world still seems to get it, even though there are kind of populist nationalist forces around the world that seem to be kind of clawing at that globalist, as they would put it, perspective on how countries should interact with one another.
Well, I think that's sort of what's so important about this year's D-Day commemoration is it's set against this backdrop of rising populism that has a familiar feel of, you know, the pre-World War II days. It's not clear. I think it's very much still in tension where, you know, what that populist movement, you know, how far it's going to go. You know, the forces against it are still at play, you know, and, you know, is there a leader sort of on the opposition side to this nationalist populist movement that is yet to emerge isn't clear. But I think for that reason, it's an important time to sort of remember what happened at D-Day and why it happened. And I just wanted to make a point, too, about the backdrop of the D-Day ceremony was Trump's trip to the UK, where he very much is pro-Brexit and anti-European Union, which again gets to this idea that he's working to corrode the very institutions that we fought so hard to create after World War II.
We will definitely talk more about the president's visit to the UK, but Hayes, I wonder what your perspective is on this kind of current world order as it relates to the forces that may be tugging at it. I mean, some of the Americans who went to France this week for the ceremonies said they're worried in light of the sharp rise in anti-Semitism in the U.S., in Europe, and elsewhere, the rise of far-right political parties. They're expressing this fear that the world is kind of forgetting what led to World War II and the lesson that we learned having defeated Nazism and fascism.
I would completely agree with that. Everyone around the table was kind of nodding as you said that, because we've all seen this over the last couple of years. And as these, you know, sort of demagogic populist leaders have been coming to power, they've been doing so on a swell of playing to people's fears. And fear is what really pulled a lot of these countries into World War II. Fear of being left behind economically, fear of the other, fear that among the German people that there was a plot against them, that the West was keeping them down, that their destiny was something greater. And that sort of fear is what you see being used to rally people around the world these days. White nationalists, their entire movement is based on the fear of being left behind and being, you know, bred out of existence. So I think when we think about what the world was like before World War II, we really do need to keep in mind how scared everyone was. And I think that part of why the world seems so stable, well, at least in retrospect, at the time it seemed very chaotic still, but seemed so stable in retrospect because we spend so much time building these institutions to allay these fears, saying we have these institutions to make it so that there's a more level playing field between countries so that fear of you being conquered can just go away, hopefully, ideally. Did that really work out over the long run? Not quite, but at least we were trying at the time, and that feels like it's going away some.
Daniel, I want to know what your take is on learning and remembering the lessons of World War II, especially in light of the rise of populist movements around the world, a rise in anti-Semitism in much of the world. We've been through World War II. We've learned these lessons. We have a UN. We have a NATO. What is your sense of the balance between those who remember and those who either don't forget or never knew?
It's a great point, and it's worth noting in this context that Donald Trump's slogan, America First, is taken from the isolationists who wanted to prevent American involvement in the rest of the world before World War II. And those kinds of instincts, along with nationalism, ethnic nationalism, weaponized tariffs, so many of the things that we see leaders and societies embracing right now are exactly the mistakes that led us up to World War II 8 decades ago. So There's a real failure on the part of societies and leaders to take into account those lessons, even though those who were present at D-Day and who were leading the U.S. and its allies on D-Day spent a lot of time building this network of institutions and relationships, as Hayes pointed out, to prevent exactly that kind of event from happening again, that kind of offensive from becoming necessary again. But it's striking that that's not something that seems to have really sunk in the West. And you know, it's of course appropriate that they're in a somewhat chilling way that the Tiananmen Square anniversary is also this week. The Chinese leaders spend a lot more time thinking about the lessons of Tiananmen than Western leaders think about the lessons of D-Day. And that, in a way, captures some of the worrying trends in our world right now.
Well, let me shift gears to Tiananmen Square. You've written extensively about that, including a book called The China Mission, George Marshall's Unfinished War, 1945-47. And this past Tuesday, June 4th, was the 30th anniversary of the massacre at Tiananmen Square in Beijing. A statement from Secretary of State Mike Pompeo read in part, quote, "We urge the Chinese government to make a full public accounting of those killed or missing to give comfort to the many victims of this dark chapter of history. Such a step would begin to demonstrate the Communist Party's willingness to respect human rights and fundamental freedoms," unquote. Before we get to the current state of affairs in China, Dan, just remind us what happened at Tiananmen Square, what led up to it, and what went on.
Sorry, so this was in 1989, a moment when there was pressure for democratization and liberalization in societies around the world. Much of the Soviet bloc was falling. There was a protest movement, a pro-democracy protest movement in the streets of Beijing in China, led by students and other activists. The Chinese leadership, after not being quite sure how to react for a while, finally decided to crack down very, very bloodily, massacring a number of people that is still not fully clear. And that has been almost entirely wiped from the memory of people in mainland China because the Communist Party has really set out to censor any news of Tiananmen Square. But it's something that leaders in China think about a lot because their foremost goal is preventing a return to the kind of instability and threat to their power that Tiananmen represented.
What's your sense, Dan, of how China responded to Pompeo's statement or any of the other comments from around the world about the Tiananmen massacre?
Any comment about these from any foreign leader or foreign activist is met with vitriolic response from Chinese leaders. They say, this is none of your business. This is our internal affair, and we do what we have to do. And that was their response to every single statement that came out this week.
Hayes?
Yeah, specifically to Pompeo's statement, the Chinese embassy in the U.S., through a spokesperson, put out a statement that said, quote, "The Chinese people have the best say on China. Their pursuit of a better life cannot be stopped by any force." Anyone who does, basically, they will only end up in the ash heap of history. So they are very strident about pushing back on any statement on Tiananmen.
Yeah, the ash heap of history is like the 180-degree opposite of we're sorry.
Yes.
Yeah.
Completely and totally.
But Kate, Brandon, what about the rest of the world? I mean, we were paying a lot of attention to D-Day, understandably, for sure. How much do you get a sense that the world was also thinking about the Tiananmen massacre? D-Day kind of took a lot of the media spotlight, at least, but did Tiananmen get ignored?
It didn't get ignored, but I don't think it got the attention it probably deserved. I think Pompeo's statement, unfortunately, the Trump administration doesn't have a lot of moral authority, and when they need it to make statements like that, to be powerful, they don't have it, and that's really unfortunate. I do think, though, sort of looking at Tiananmen and the Chinese government's ability to censor it within the country is really important, sort of as we discuss more broadly the themes of like social media and its ability to empower authoritarian regimes, sort of the post-Tiananmen lessons of how the Chinese government has suppressed that memory, I think are really important for everybody to consider.
Dan? It's also worth noting that this week, Xi Jinping, the Chinese leader, was in Moscow meeting with Vladimir Putin. And the symbolic power of those two meeting and really trying to demonstrate that history was on their side as Western leaders were commemorating D-Day was a really powerful image.
Hayes, it's interesting, the statement from the Secretary of State and the relationship between the U.S. and China in the last few years. Let me read another piece of Secretary Pompeo's statement. He also wrote, quote, "Today, Chinese citizens have been subjected to a new wave of abuses, especially in Xinjiang, where the Communist Party leadership is methodically attempting to strangle Uyghur culture and stamp out the Islamic faith, including through the detention of more than 1 million members of Muslim minority groups," unquote. I wonder what your sense is of the U.S.-China relationship on moments like these, especially because of the way that President Trump and Xi Jinping have been relating, and especially over the human rights thing. I mean, this is the same administration whose president said we have to restrict people from these countries until we figure out, and I quote, what the hell is going on.
Right. So I think that what's interesting about the Trump administration is in past administrations, you saw with China an attempt to uncouple some of these issues. You tried to keep trade separate from human rights, separate from partnership in global institutions around the world. But under Trump, everything is linked together. Everything is one of the same piece in his mind. And so you see a China policy where the focus is heavily on trade, but we're also trying to link that to human rights. So I think that in this moment, the U.S., unfortunately, we also really don't have a lot of moral high ground at this moment to lecture Beijing about the atrocities that are happening in Xinjiang that have been, you know, widely reported about in the Western press. So it's not really clear what the Trump administration can achieve in terms of pressuring China on all these fronts at the same time.
Before we move on, Dan, who might have that moral high ground? I mean, is there anything, you know, in China's future, any future touch points in terms of its aims or goals or you know, conflicts around the world that might illustrate who can put that message to China and have it stick?
China resists any commentary on these kinds of issues from anyone outside of China. All that said, this comes in the context of a real deterioration in the U.S.-China relationship. I think this precedes Trump. Donald Trump has made it a more theatrical conflict in many ways, but the tension on economic issues, on human rights issues, on global security issues, the South China Sea and other regional issues in Asia really reflects, I think, what's going to be a long-term tension between the two countries.
Let's get to a few of your comments. We asked for your remembrances and your family stories about World War II. Suzanne in Nebraska emailed, "My father was a captain in the Army Artillery during World War II and was a part of storming the west coast of Italy to rid Europe of the other dictator, Benito Mussolini. It occurred at the same time as the Normandy invasion, and he viewed it as the forgotten military operation, which was as effective as the operation in France." Hafiz tweeted, "Peaceful Sudanese protesters were slaughtered on Monday by the Transitional Military Council and the Rapid Response Forces. They were killed just because they wanted justice, democracy, and democratic government that represent their hopes and dreams." Glad Hafiz brought that up. It's probably a perfect place to transition from talking about the history of pro-democracy massacres, because there is one happening right now in Sudan. There's been a sit-in outside the military headquarters in Khartoum. It's been going on for weeks, and it ended this week very tragically. Dozens of people were killed after Sudanese security forces attacked the protesters. It's their worst violence since Omar al-Bashir, the former longtime leader, was deposed back in April. Kate Brennan, what led to this violence? Was there a tipping point that caused this to degenerate into violence?
Well, with the coup that deposed Bashir, the people were hoping for civilian rule, and instead what it looks like they're getting is somebody even more hard-line than Bashir. And as talk of elections came up, this is what sort of tipped it off this week, I believe. Unfortunately, the Transitional Military Council has, you know, really powerful backers globally, Saudi Arabia, the United Arab Emirates, and then Russia and China blocked a vote at the UN this week to condemn the violence. So the picture's sort of, I think, really grim when it comes to whether or not there'll be sort of international unity coalition around condemning what happened there.
There's also the African Union suspending Sudan. Here is a brief clip from Patrick Kapua, who is the AU's Peace and Security Council chairperson.
Should the Transitional Military Council fail to hand over power to a civilian-led transitional authority without any further delay, Council will automatically impose punitive measures on individuals and entities that are obstructing the establishment of a civilian-led transitional authority.
That's Patrick Kapua, who is the African Union's Peace and Security Council chairperson. Hayes, what impact do we expect that to have? I mean, is there anything that can really be done from any of these international organizations or other nations to try to make peace in Sudan?
I mean, I think that it's possible, but I think it's going to take a lot of will and effort that I'm not really sure is there. The African Union suspending Sudan and threatening punitive measures, which I would assume would mean economic sanctions and travel bans on the members of this transitional council, I think that it would need a further step. And I think that the UN Security Council would need to impose sanctions as well for it to have a real effect on the thinking of this group. But on the flip side, Sudan under Bashir was sanctioned to hell. Bashir himself was indicted by the ICC, the International Criminal Court, and that didn't really seem to change much on the ground. So I really hope that these measures that they take will convince the Transitional Council to stop attacking civilians, to hold forth to their promises, to have elections. But I'm not really sure how quickly even that would happen if that is the case.
We should also note, Dan, that Ethiopia's Prime Minister Abiy Ahmed is in Khartoum to try to mediate between the military and the opposition. Are there hopes for that?
It's striking that the real leaders in trying to solve this that leadership has come from the rest of the region, while much of the international community is absent, starting with the United States. The real players, as Kate pointed out, are some of the regional powers and the Middle Eastern powers that see this as a repeat of the Arab Spring events of 2011, and they see this as a chance to learn the lessons of those events and make sure that authoritarian leaders are able to stay in power. So you have, on the one hand, this regional leadership from other African leaders, but Russia and China, Saudi Arabia, the United Arab Emirates, really setting out to support military rule in Khartoum, and that's a hard obstacle to overcome.
Let's head to the UK, where today is the last day that British Prime Minister Theresa May is officially the head of the Conservative Party. Now, let's clarify this for those of us who don't live in a parliamentary governmental system. Theresa May is still the Prime Minister, but she's stepping down as the leader of her political party, the Conservative Party. That's effective today. She'll remain Prime Minister and keep fulfilling her official duties until there is a successor chosen, and the leadership contest for a new Conservative Party leader will begin on Monday. Kate, Brandon, are there any leading contenders to replace her? There have been plenty of politicos who've made a lot of noise since she's kind of been beaten down by Brexit, but who are the serious contenders to be the next Prime Minister?
It is a wide field, which I was surprised. It sort of reminded me of the Democratic presidential primaries. Just there's like a lot of people who want this very unattractive job, as far as
that.
I can tell.
It can't be that bad.
It's not quite as many people, but it's a lot. But the leader is Boris Johnson, who has, you know, the most international name recognition. And he is very pro-Brexit and has even entertained the idea of a no-deal Brexit. I believe that there are two other top contenders, but he's really the leading one. Michael Gove, who's the environment minister, I believe. But they're all, you know, because of the party, they're all pro-Brexit, but with varying degrees of how they're going to manage it and whether they'll get, you know, a better deal than Theresa May got. But I mean, as far as anyone can tell, you know, they're selling something that's, you know, unattractive to the British public. It's not going to be better than the status quo. So it's like a losing battle.
Yeah, Hayes, why, other than the fact that the UK has to have a prime minister?
Yeah.
Why would you raise your hand? I understand Boris Johnson. I understand why he is raising his hand for this. That makes sense. He's had very big political aspirations for a long time. So now kind of maybe his moment. But other than the Boris Johnsons of the world, Who wants to walk into this buzzsaw?
Literally, no one should want this. I mean, only people who are delusional about what they can actually achieve at this moment, I think, are
but
the ones
who...
But
they've got to achieve something.
They have to do something. They have to do something. They either have to manage to pull their country into agreeing to the deal that Theresa May had, they need to brace themselves for a no-deal Brexit, or they need to figure out some heretofore unfound solution to Brexit that everyone seems to think is just around the corner, much like victory in Afghanistan, that just is not going to come to them. So this contest is really a race to see who can lead the Conservative Party, not to lead the United Kingdom, in my point of view.
Yeah, Dan, where does this go from here? I mean, is there a... The timeline, obviously, the Conservative leadership contest begins on Monday. When does the attrition begin? When do we start to get a clear idea of who the real prime minister is going to be?
So I think the question is, what happens with Boris Johnson? If he falters and it looks to be a more open field, my sense would be that you'll see all of these other contenders continuing to vie for the mantle if he does not claim it. If he really seems to secure it, if he does not step on his own toes and say things that prove too outrageous, then it's likely that some of the others will not see a path forward. Let me offer a quick glimmer of hope, perhaps. I think that if there is one in this case, it is that someone like Boris Johnson is more likely to sell a deal than Theresa May was. Theresa May was never really pro-Brexit, which made it hard for her to convince the pro-Brexit crowd in her own party to accept what she was offering them. Boris Johnson, who has been such an ardent supporter of it, may be able to sell something. There's a Nixon goes to China quality to this.
Yeah, as I recall, Hayes, Theresa May voted against Brexit, but when she became the prime minister, she said, we are going to deliver Brexit.
Right, that's the weird paradox of Brexit and Theresa May. I feel like without Brexit, it was very unlikely that former Home Secretary Theresa May could have risen to become prime minister. I just don't think that she would have had the opportunity, the room, to have that shot if she didn't say, I'm the one who can deliver Brexit. But getting there, she spent her entire time trying to fight off an assault from her right, who were trying to push for just a no deal. So I think that the tragedy of Theresa May is that she won on Brexit and she lost on Brexit. And so her successor has just the hardest job in Europe after this, I think. But Boris, BuzzFeed News' Alberto Nardelli, based in London, he had some great reporting saying that Boris Johnson, he's liked but not respected. He didn't do his reading, so European diplomats are kind of wary about what it'll look like with him as premier.
Another story we've had our eye on comes out of India. It's experiencing a dangerous heat wave with temperatures over 120 degrees Fahrenheit. That's more than 50 degrees Celsius. The heat has reportedly killed at least 24 people. Authorities are trying to prevent further deaths. They're issuing authorities for best practices, spraying the streets with water to prevent the roads from melting. Dangerous heat at these levels has become the norm in India. It's experienced 11 of its warmest years out of the last 15 years. Let's back up to the president's visit to the UK. A number of people there had a lot of things to say about his arrival. The president had his own thoughts as well, including about Sadiq Khan, who is the mayor of London. Here is part of what President Trump said about London's mayor during a press conference alongside Prime Minister Theresa May.
Well, I think he's been a not very good mayor, from what I understand. He's done a poor job. Crime is up, a lot of problems. And I don't think he should be criticizing a representative of the United States that can do so much good for the United Kingdom. We talked about it before. He should be positive, not negative. He's a negative force, not a positive force.
Now, during that same press conference, President Trump also spoke about the protests that were directed toward him and his visit.
As far as the protests, I have to tell you, because I commented on it yesterday, we left the Prime Minister, the Queen, the royal family. There were thousands of people on the streets cheering. And even coming over today, there were thousands of people cheering. And then I heard that there were protests. I said, where are the protests? I don't see any protests. I did see a small protest today when I came, very small. So a lot of it is fake news, I hate to say.
Yeah, the president has referred to the factual news of the existence of these real and actual protests fake. Kate Brannon, there's no real love lost, I think, between the UK and President Trump. But is there a contingent in the UK that sees the president's policies as matching their own in some way? Like, does he have any support base in the UK?
I mean, I
don't know about thousands of people cheering his name, but, you know, is there any support?
I think the same people who support Nigel Farage are Trumpers, for mm-hmm. sure. I think there's like a Trumpist vibe.
Nigel Farage, the politician who led the push for Brexit.
Exactly, yeah. There's a definitely, you know, that same populist movement that we were talking about earlier is, you know, one of the things that the UK is contending with, if not as much as the United States. I was going to say you know, him saying that there were no protests. You know, it's been reported that he was using a helicopter to get around, meaning he wasn't driving on the streets seeing any of the protests. And it reminded me of the tarp supposedly thrown over the USS John McCain on his trip to Japan. There's, you know, efforts are taken to protect him from reality and to sort of see, you know, protect his ego from feeling hurt that his staff do and that he does himself. So,
Dan? I think Trump seemed to be enjoying the prospect of seeing Theresa May gone. It was this kind of sad swan song for her before she stepped down. But he seemed to really enjoy the prospect of a Boris Johnson or someone like that who really does embody the same kind of political impulses as he does taking over the UK and seeing a real, real kind of meeting of the minds there.
Now, while he was there, he met with Prince Charles for an hour and a half. The opposition party leader, the Labour Party leader, Jeremy Corbyn, refused to meet with him. Also during the president's visit, he gave an interview to Piers Morgan, who hosts Good Morning Britain on ITV. And during that interview, the president was asked about his stance on Vietnam, on the Vietnam War. Listen.
Well, I was never a fan of that war, I'll be honest with you. I thought it was a terrible war. I thought it was very far away. Nobody ever, you know, you're talking about Vietnam, and at that time, nobody ever heard of the country. This isn't like I'm fighting against Nazi Germany. We're fighting against Hitler. And I was like a lot of people. Now, I wasn't out in the streets marching. I wasn't saying, you know, I'm going to move to Canada, which a lot of people did. But no, I was not a fan of that war. That war was not something
that we
should have
been involved. Would you like to serve generally, perhaps in another?
I would not have minded that at all. I would have been honored, but I think I'd make up for it right now. I look, $700 billion I gave last year, and then this year, $716 billion.
Part of President Trump's interview with Piers Morgan on ITV's Good Morning Britain. Hayes Brown, I wonder what you... don't smirk at me before I ask the question.
I'm sorry. Continue, please.
No, what's the point? Say it.
Given what we know about how Donald Trump managed to avoid going to Vietnam, the fact that he claimed that he had bone spurs, and the fact that he later on referred to dating in New York City in the 1980s during the AIDS crisis as his personal Vietnam, it just is wild to hear him try to make the claim that, oh yeah, I would have loved to have served if I'd been given the chance. Like, it's just so... so fake. It's just so fake to hear him try. And also, part of that smirk was the fact that he said, I gave the military. I gave the military $700 billion last year. So that really
not
makes
up for the fact. Not a congressional defense appropriation.
Not at all, no. He, Donald Trump, gave this money to the military. So that's just like having served in Vietnam.
Was there anything useful that we learned from this interview, Hayes or Kate? Like, was this all kind of heat or was there any light in this interview?
He brought up a new reason why transgender people can't serve in the military, which is apparently that they take too many drugs, which hasn't been floated before and is complete. I don't want to swear on air, but...
Drugs like controlled substances or like hormones for gender?
Hormones, yeah, post-surgery or something. So, I mean, if anything, that exposed the absolute nonsense and absurdity of that policy even further than already had been, so...
Worth noting that there was a report, I believe, by the RAND Corporation that was done some years ago that showed that the cost of service members who are gender non-binary serving openly in the military would be minimal, that it would be easily absorbed by the United States Defense Department. So
I did give credit to Piers. I think he brought up that you know, other people in the military take Viagra, which I thought was a great point.
and cost more than the drugs for transgender. Right.
Yeah. And just to be clear, the $716 billion he's talking about, that's the defense budget is what he's referring to. Gotcha. Speaking of defense spending, we'll talk about Saudi Arabia in just one second. I do want to get to some comments about D-Day. We've heard from several of you who've commented along this line. Ibrahim commented on our Facebook page, as we remember the fallen through the D-Day commemoration, let's not forget thousands of Africans who were forced into a war that had nothing to do with them and who gave their lives to free countries that still maintain them in subhuman servitude. Daniel emailed, I watched a few D-Day memorials yesterday. Not one showed pictures or even mentioned African American soldiers, sailors, or airmen. Thanks, America. Let's talk about military sales, particularly to Saudi Arabia. 2 weeks ago, the Secretary of State announced that the White House was going forward with $8 billion in sales to Saudi Arabia without Congress's approval, which is not usually how this works. And Congress noticed, including one of the president's frequent supporters, Republican Senator Lindsey Graham of South Carolina.
Yeah, I've got a real problem with going back to doing business as usual with Saudi Arabia. Jordan's a great ally. The UAE has been problematic in Yemen, but a good ally. Saudi Arabia is a strategic ally, but the crown prince was, in my opinion, involved in the murder of Mr. Khashoggi, and he's done a lot of other disruptive things. So I don't support the arms sales now.
That was Republican Senator Lindsey Graham of South Carolina speaking on Fox News Sunday. Now, this week, a bipartisan group of senators acted on those concerns. They submitted 22 resolutions to try to block the weapons sales. Kate, what's your sense of what's going on here? First of all, how the administration could do the end run around Congress, and then whether these resolutions have any chance of having an effect.
Well, the way they did it was they declared a national emergency related to tensions with Iran. The way they, you know, this clause in the law that they're using is very rarely used. It was invoked in 1979 and I think 1981 maybe, but related to sort of actual things that were happening versus this sort of nebulous Iranian tension that they're alluding to. I think what Congress is doing, they're not just opposed to the policy vis-a-vis Saudi Arabia and Khashoggi, but they're also reclaiming their own power. The White House is basically taking away congressional review of arms sales, and it's important that they sort of stand up and say, no, we have a role in this. And I think that's one of the reasons why Lindsey Graham is also opposed. Yes, Saudi, his fears about what's going on with Saudi Arabia, but also sort of reclaiming congressional sort of prerogative and authority.
Dan, do you have any sense of whether these resolutions have a chance of passing or whether the standoff is going to end anytime soon?
It's a reminder of just how much power the president has to control foreign policy. It's going to be very hard for even a determined Congress to do much to overcome the desire of the administration to continue supporting Saudi Arabia in its war in Yemen. And it's worth stepping back and just remembering what the toll of that war is. Over 4 years, it's created one of the worst humanitarian catastrophes on earth. Hundreds of thousands of children dead, mass starvation, and Congress really started to pay attention to that after the murder of Jamal Khashoggi. But it's been an ongoing disaster that the world really has paid minimal attention to.
Hey, let me back up to the UK story before we keep going. With regards to meeting with the Labour Party leader Jeremy Corbyn, we should note that President Trump said that Corbyn offered to meet with him, and the president said no. The president said, quote, "I don't know Jeremy Corbyn. He wanted to meet today. I said no. He is somewhat of a negative force. I have decided not to meet," unquote. The Trump administration has imposed some new restrictions on Americans going to Cuba. The U.S. will no longer let cruise ships, yachts, fishing vessels, or educational and cultural exchange groups stop on the island. Hayes Brown, one of the last things that the Obama administration did before it left was relaxing some of the restrictions, including in telecommunications and banking. What's the rationale for rolling that back?
The rationale for rolling that back is John Bolton hates communism, is the shortest way I can put that. I think that the view from a lot of people, a lot of Republicans, especially when Obama and his administration rolled back some of those things, was that we were caving to Cuba and holding on to this idea that if we just embargo them for a little bit longer, the Castro regime, the regime that Castro built, would fall. So I think it's in that sense, in that vein, that the Trump administration has decided, no, we're going to be rolling back these changes. So a lot of people who had been planning on traveling to Cuba are left kind of in the lurch. The people-to-people, the cultural exchanges that you mentioned, those were a real source of ire for a lot of these Republicans because they just felt it was tourism, that there was no real cultural value to this, that it was just Americans going to spend money in Cuba.
Let me stick with you, Hayes, for just a minute with a story out of Australia. Police there raided the Sydney headquarters of its public broadcaster, the Australian Broadcasting Corporation. They had search warrants for two reporters and the news director. related to what they called, quote, allegations of publishing classified material, unquote. Now, the ABC's news director later said the raid was related to an investigation they aired last year called the Afghan Files. It revealed dozens of allegations of murders, rapes, other crimes perpetrated by Australian soldiers on Afghan civilians during the war in Afghanistan. Hayes, this seems pretty blatant, although, you know, rules for free press are different from country to country, but what happens now?
Seems bad. Seems really bad. So I think what happens now is it really... Australian politics is such a mess, though. I mean, they've been through so many prime ministers in such a short amount of time that I think that what remains to be seen is what the public reaction is going to be. Will the Australian public react to this and say, no, this is wrong, we need to put into place stronger freedoms for the press because we need to know what our military is doing in these adventures overseas? Or will it just kind of slip by and these national security laws remain in place? That's really unclear to me right now, but it really is up to the public reaction, I think.
A few more things before we go. Game 4 of the NBA Finals is tonight. My Golden State Warriors are taking their time winning the series. The Raptors are ahead 2-1, but that's okay. Tonight's game is in Oakland. One listener noted how very international the Toronto Raptors are. A Song for Today tweeted, "If you're going to discuss the Raptors, please note that Masai Ujiri, the team's general manager, is Nigerian, and the roster includes OG Anunoby, who's British with parents from Nigeria, Mark Gasol, who's from Spain, Serge Ibaka of the Congo, Pascal Siakam of Cameroon, and Jeremy Lin, who was born in California but whose parents immigrated from Taiwan." A Song, thanks for the tweet, but you missed one. Chris Boucher, who is from St. Lucia. Before we go, two quick stories about temptation. Pope Francis has approved a revision to the Lord's Prayer. Christians worldwide know that the prayer that Jesus taught his disciples begins, "Our Father who art in heaven." The Pope called for a new version of the line, "And lead us not into temptation." Reportedly, the wording of it was a bit confusing as to its intent. The approved revision says, "And do not let us fall into temptation." But there's one temptation the world has a hard time not falling into, and thankfully, our supplies of Nutella shall remain plentiful. A factory in Normandy produces 600,000 jars every day. It's a quarter of the global supply. Its workers went on strike for more than a week. They blocked trucks from getting in or getting out. They were demanding pay raises of 4.5% and a bonus of 900 euro, which is just over $1,000. It's unclear exactly why the blockade ended, but a spokesperson said that negotiations are still taking place. And as faithful a believer as I can, without that Nutella, I'm so, what? What's wrong with that?
Nothing wrong with that. I'm happy you're such a fan of the delicious hazelnut spread.
See, the fact that you called it a delicious hazelnut spread, I think you might be a closet fan too, Hayes Brown. He's the Deputy World News Editor for BuzzFeed News. Hayes, thanks for spending the hour with us.
Thanks for having me.
Kate Brannon, Editorial Director of Just Security. Kate, thank you.
Thank you. I'm going to have some Nutella.
Yeah. I'm coming with you. We're going to talk after that. Daniel Kurtz-Phelan, Executive Editor of Foreign Affairs and the author of The China Mission, George Marshall's Unfinished War, 1945 to 1947. Thanks, Dan.
Thank you.
1A's senior team includes Daniel Knight, Lindsay Foster-Thomas, and Denise Couture. Miranda Fulmore edits the program. To learn more about them and the rest of the team, visit the1a.org/staff. This program comes to you from WAMU, part of American University in Washington, distributed by NPR. We're back in D.C. next week. Until we meet again, I'm Joshua Johnson. Thanks for listening and have a good weekend. This is 1A.